Eubank et al. Versus Thomas et al. Britton J. Bohannon, Appellant's Counsel. Julie S. Palmer, Appellee's Counsel.
Mr. Bohannon, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Brenton J. Bohannon. I'm joined here by Samantha Bohannon. I represent the appellant, Arthur Candy Eubank. I ask 3 minutes to be reserved for rebuttal. This case comes on from Matthews County. The facts of this case involve a malicious prosecution against Mr. and Mrs. Eubank. This entire ordeal began when the county attempted to increase public beach access. Defendants had a surveyor place stakes on both the Eubanks and their neighbor's property with the words Matthews County, thereby asserting a county interest to their property. Upon seeing the stakes, the Eubanks and their neighbor had an informal meeting with Defendant Shaw to inquire why the county had placed stakes on their property. At the conclusion of the meeting, Defendant Shaw took a Sharpie and crossed out Matthews County off the stakes. Sometimes after this meeting, the defendants began researching zoning issues on the two houses straddling VDOT's Bird Act easement, my clients being one of those houses. Historically, the public had accessed the waters through the Bird Act easement. It was very thin and narrow, but they accessed it that way. Initially, this has become an issue, and that's where everything really started up. Was because of parking issues and some complaints about cleanliness, and that's what really brought this to head. Initially, the county pursued violations against the Eubanks' neighbor. He had a mobile home on his property. He'd lived there for 20 plus years, but he was told he needed to remove the home. He decided to build a house on the property. And that stopped the issues of the county. And shortly afterwards, the defendants turned their attention to the appellants. The defendants issued a notice of violation alleging an unpermitted addition to the family home in Matthews County. The alleged 4-foot addition never existed. Several communications were made between the parties about this fact, including a letter to the effect by a well-known surveyor to the county. And I believe he's even been used by the county. The surveyor stated that the home's footprint was unchanged since 1966, which was the original time of the home. Thinking that the information was sufficient to address the NOV, the appellants did not appeal the decision. They did not see the need to defend against a fictitious violation. It's incorrect that the Eubanks had legal counsel for this matter at that point. They were represented at the time by other counsel in an action against VDOT for diverting stormwater drainage onto their property, located in Matthews County, to increase public beach access as well. And so they later got counsel, other counsel, to help them with other NOVs, but I don't believe they had any counsel at this point in time.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. May I ask you this? Did the 1966 drawing or plat show an encroachment or not of any kind?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe there was an encroachment. I think it was kind of one of those situations where everybody kind of had an encroachment in the area. So nothing had changed there. The 4-foot addition, I believe, was alleged on a pump house. They had covered a pump house or something. Something was alleged somehow there.
So let me follow up, though, and ask. So assume for the sake of argument, you're 100% right. There was no little pump house there, but there was technically an encroachment. Doesn't the Matthews City Ordinance 175-20.1 make it a violation to either create or to use an encroachment? Do I read it correctly?
Your Honor, my belief is that because it was unstated, it was grandfathered in, essentially, since all that time had passed, that it would not have been a problem, and it could have stayed as such. And I believe that was even found later on, because the house in the other part encroaches into the RPA, but it was prior to that. So as long as the footprint of the structure remained the same prior to, I believe, the ordinance being enacted and how it had been for so many years, it was not a violation, just fine to remain that.
Thank you.
Counsel, counsel, excuse me, this is Justice Chaffin. You indicated that that was grandfathered. What do you have? Do you have a document or is there an ordinance that indicates that encroachments, if they are of 4 feet or less, are grandfathered in? Is there, do you have anything to point to that, any evidence?
I do not have anything right in front of me, but there is a code section, and forgive me, I cannot remember the exact code section off the top of my head. But there is one that if you've been paying taxes on the structure for a time period of 15 years, then it is deemed, it's non-conforming, but it is allowed to stay. I do not have the exact code section. Let's see, it's
okay,
13.
Then would that be an ordinance that was enacted by the county, Matthews County? Is that what you're referring
to? No, Your Honor. That would be, I believe, Virginia State Code.
Virginia State Code, okay. And with that, with your recollection of the statute, would that still not require the Eubanks to ask the Zoning Commission of Matthews County for a variance based upon that?
No, Your Honor. I think once it's done, it's there. Now, if they wanted to change the footprint, that is absolutely correct. They would have to go through a variance if they wanted to change the footprint. But seeing as how they had not changed the footprint in that area, it did not require anything.
Thank you.
So, Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey again. To cut to the chase, if I'm a zoning person and I see the 1966 drawing and I go, well, this is an encroachment, does that mean because of the reason that it may be non-conforming but still okay later under the Virginia Code that I have no probable cause to go forward and to force the issue? I guess the point is the other side says that the 1966 event is a technical violation of the Matthews Ordinance. If that is true, wouldn't that be probable cause to follow up on it?
I would say no, it is not, respectfully, because the ordinance was after the 1966 building of this home. So everything at that point was grandfathered in. They just couldn't change that. I believe they had other counsel to help deal with this type issue in other areas, and then I represented them later down the road in a couple of other areas. And in the one I didn't represent, I believe there was quite a bit of litigation as to whether or not they could go up and what they could do in the top part of the structure. But no, it would be my belief that you could not find a violation, so to speak, after you change the rules on the house and then go after that violation. So once it's prior and it's already in and it's grandfathered, they cannot go after them for a violation. They can only deem it as non-conforming.
Okay. Thank you.
Counsel, this is Justice Goodwin. I have a question for you. When they sent the notice of violation, didn't they also indicate corrective actions that the Eubanks could take, which included a plat prepared by a licensed surveyor showing that the original footprint had not been expanded? And isn't that what they provided?
Yes, the Eubanks did. They had a surveyor go through it. Mr. Lewis, I believe, or he went, he did the survey, and they provided that with the surveyor had provided this letter saying that nothing had changed in the survey, that nothing had changed in the plat, that everything was the same, and that this alleged violation did not exist. I believe he had even called and talked to him in person, but he did send a letter.
But that was something that they said would remedy the violation, isn't it?
That was indicated that it would remedy the violation. It apparently did not. My clients, their position was it didn't exist, that nothing had happened, and so they didn't need to go about with it. And there were several communications about this back and forth. Memory serves, I think it's about 6 communications.
All right, thank you.
The question presented, there's 3 questions presented in this. Did the court err in granting the defendant's demur for malicious prosecution by ruling that probable cause existed because of the thing decided doctrine? Also, does the doctrine of a thing decided unequivocally create probable cause when the existence of further facts would lead a reasonable person to believe otherwise, and at a minimum, it's a question for the trier of fact? And did the court err by granting defendants demur in the abuse of process, claiming that there's no facts to suggest that an action had been taken after the charging document? On the demur, the only issue that's before the circuit court is considering the demur was whether the complaint stated a prima facie cause of action. The demur is granted based on a finding that probable cause existed. It's in Appendix 88, line 12 through 14. The finding that probable cause existed because a thing decided doctrine establishes probable cause is not the standard for a demur. The proper standard for granting the demur was whether or not the complaint alleged sufficient facts so that a trier of fact could determine whether there was a lack of probable cause. So essentially, the appellant's alleged facts, that would have been enough that a trier of fact could reasonably determine that it lost probable cause, or that it lacked probable cause, namely the omission and other such by defendants. Turning to probable cause, it's really 2 key issues. Does the doctrine of a thing decided conclusively establish probable cause, even when the predicated facts for its basis are known to be false? And does an enforcement officer have a duty to disclose all relevant facts, including exculpatory evidence, when seeking charges and aiding a prosecution? Appellants contend that there is a duty to disclose all pertinent and relevant facts when seeking criminal charges. One thing that lends support to this is the affirmation, according to Virginia Supreme Court Rule 2:603, that is the affirmation or swear to tell the truth. Often stated as to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, but there is no form for it. Our position is that without all the relevant facts, especially one as significant as this, that a judicial officer cannot make an informed decision about probable cause, and that the fact that it did not exist and that they had been given a letter by a very qualified surveyor saying that there was no addition, that should have been presented at a minimum. Appellants contend that a conscious and willful omission of exculpatory information is a violation of this principle and requirement. We also argue that it falls in line with, we're not asserting a Brady violation by no means. It does not apply in that. But the spirit of Brady is what we're looking at, and other cases that follow in that the government in prosecution of cases, police officers, enforcement officers, they have a duty to disclose exculpatory evidence. They have a duty to disclose everything, that they have a duty of honesty and upfrontness. And it doesn't matter what they believe is relevant or what the weight of it would be, that they have this duty to disclose.
Mr. Bohannon, you have 52 seconds remaining. Do you want to reserve it, or you can use your time any way you like?
Your Honor, I will just close with this. The arguments for the abuse of process as well, it's similar to the malicious prosecution. The omission, the lack of giving information to the prosecutor, is an action that was taken by the county. Thank you, Your Honor. I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Ms. Palmer, you may proceed.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Julie Palmer, and I represent the appellees Melinda Connor, Sue Thomas, and John Shaw in this action. It was procedurally proper for the trial court to sustain this demur and to decide the case at the demur stage. Further, the trial court correctly sustained the demur to both claims that were asserted in the Eubanks complaint. This court should affirm the trial court's ruling. Addressing the procedural aspect of the assignment of error first, which is whether the trial court correctly decided the case on demur. It is well established in the case law of Virginia that an allegation that the prosecution under examination was instituted without probable cause is one of the elements of the claim of malicious prosecution. It is an element on which the plaintiff has the burden of proving and of pleading. It is not an affirmative defense on which the defendant has the burden. In Andrews
Counsel,
versus Rain and
Justice
many other...
Kelsey, if I may interrupt you.
Yes.
May I ask the same questions that were asked of your of opposing counsel? What is the relevance, if any, of the 1966 drawing that shows that there, allegedly shows there was an encroachment, but not of this, not of a particular building or anything else?
Well, I believe that there was a violation shown on the 1966 survey that the county could have proceeded to enforce. Moreover, the county found, or at least believed it had found, an additional encroachment, which was also in violation of the county ordinance. So for either of both of those findings, the county was authorized to issue the notice of violation and to start the process. The complaint established that the Eubanks received the notice of violation, that it set forth the allegation in the October 5th, 2015 notice of violation focused on an alleged additional encroachment, the 4-foot expansion. But whether it was issued relating to the original survey, the original condition shown on the original survey, or the believed expansion, the process started with the issuance of the notice of violation, and the Eubanks had two options at that point. Both options were clearly set forth on the face of the notice. They were to implement the corrective action set forth in the notice or to appeal the decision to the Board of Zoning Appeals. The complaint
May I interrupt
established...
you again? I'm sorry, but going back to Justice Goodwin's question earlier, what about the letter saying, well, you told us that if the original footprint had not been expanded, you'd be happy with that and we wouldn't be going forward with any of this? And they gave the evidence that they hadn't expanded it. Nothing's happened as far as they were concerned from 1966 forward. Assuming those facts are right, what's the response to that?
Well, the facts as alleged in the complaint were not as certain as they've been stated here today. The complaint alleged in paragraphs 51 and 54 that the Eubanks provided a letter from a surveyor. The notice of the violation, which the trial court properly considered on demur, the motion for craving lawyer having been granted, the notice of violation stated that a survey or a plat prepared by a licensed surveyor was required corrective action, not a letter. Moreover, the letter, which was quoted in the complaint by the surveyor, indicated that the original footprint of the house, that the current existent condition of the house, quote, appeared consistent with the survey. It was not a plat showing definitively that the footprint had not been expanded. It was an opinion based upon who knows what that the footprint, quote, appeared to be consistent with. That was insufficient. The Eubanks knew that would be insufficient because, again, the notice of violation stated on its face what the corrective actions needed to be, and a letter from a surveyor was not within the purview of the corrective action. Moreover, the notice, again, stated on its face that there was a right of appeal within 30 days from receiving the notice of violation, and that if the violation was not appealed, that the decision would be final and unappealable. That appears on page 20 of the appendix.
It further went on. This is Justice Powell. Help me with the facts. The notice of violation comes out. It gives them two potential corrective actions.
Yes, Your Honor.
They take an action, which the county suggests it was not in the form that we requested. Is there anything from the county after that to say we don't find this document sufficient?
That was not alleged in the complaint, Your Honor. No, there was no allegation in the complaint other that other than that there were communications between the Eubanks and the county pertaining to the notice of violation that, and this can be reasonably inferred because, of course, there's no allegation that the notice of violation was appealed, so we can infer from the complaint that there was no appeal. And what the complaint established significantly is that it was more than 30 days after the notice of violation was issued that the county took the next step of obtaining the summonses against the Eubanks. So there were no facts to contradict the trial court's finding that, again, a plain reading of the notice of violation set forth what actions could be taken. The Eubanks knew, or certainly should have known, that they hadn't taken those actions. Therefore, they knew that their only recourse was to appeal the decision to the Board of Zoning Appeals. Not having done that, according to this court's jurisprudence, those violations became a fact. They became a thing decided. They were conclusively established. And at that point, they provided definitive probable cause for the county to move forward with issuing the summonses.
You know, can I interrupt you with that question?
Yes, Your Honor.
It sounds as though we're taking two different doctrines and melding them together. If you want to use the analog of criminal law, if a conviction or criminal conviction based upon assertions of beyond reasonable doubt being accepted by a fact finder that's become final and unappealable and not subject to habeas, then it clearly is final and there's no collateral attack allowed. But I don't know that that addresses the underlying question of probable cause for some unrelated tort. In other words, the doctrine you're talking about doesn't end with the conclusion, therefore there was no probable cause. It just ends with the conclusion, you can't collaterally attack this in some other case. So isn't that a different conceptual point?
I don't believe it's different conceptually, Your Honor. I do believe it is different, and you are correct. Our research has not revealed a case addressing the intersection between the thing decided doctrine and a claim for malicious prosecution. However, this court in Lilly against Caroline County, 259 Virginia 291, recognized the doctrine of a thing decided and, you know, stated if the mandatory appeal to the Board of Zoning Appeals is not pursued, then the administrative remedies have not been exhausted, and that finding becomes a thing decided, not subject to court challenge. Not subject to court challenge means in any proceeding, not just a collateral proceeding attacking the very decision. If the doctrine is going to have meaning, it has to apply across the board with respect to that outcome, which is once you fail to exhaust your administrative remedies, you've given up your right to challenge the decision. And so it is a thing decided. And so when you look at the definition of probable cause in the context of malicious prosecution, which is set forth in one of many cases, Lewis versus Kai, 281 Virginia 715, the definition is knowledge of such a state of facts and circumstances as excite the belief in a reasonable mind acting on such facts and circumstances that the plaintiff is guilty of the crime of which he is suspected. Any reasonable person, understanding that the plaintiff had the right to fight the notice of violation, didn't do it, didn't correct it, and therefore allowed it to become a thing decided, that is probable cause as a matter of law.
May I ask you this? I mean, one of the things that's perplexing, and this is Justice McCullough, one of the things that's perplexing about this is, so you have this sort of basically a government official saying there's a violation. They dispute that, but they don't appeal it up the line. What then comes is a criminal prosecution in which, according to the allegations of the complaint, they won. So how can there be a thing decided preliminarily when in the aftermath following this criminal proceeding, they prevailed? Doesn't that seem odd that there's a thing decided on a violation for which ultimately the landlords or the landowners were successful?
Well, they were successful in that the summonses were null prost by the Commonwealth's attorney. I don't know whether the thing decided doctrine was ever raised in the criminal proceeding, but I would agree with you that if it had been raised, I believe it should have resulted in the county being successful on those issues. But those facts certainly weren't alleged on the complaint and weren't before the trial court on the demur. Further supporting the trial court's sustaining of the demur are two principles that come into play here that this court has recognized repeatedly. One is that great deference is given to the decisions of zoning administrators. The other is that malicious prosecution is a disfavored tort, particularly malicious prosecution claims arising from criminal proceedings. As this court stated in the Ayildiz versus Kidd, 220 Virginia 1080, and many other cases, the requirements for maintaining an action for malicious prosecution arising from a criminal case are more stringent than those applied to other tort actions. These stringent requirements are designed to encourage persons to bring criminal actions in appropriate cases without fear of reprisal by civil actions, because criminal prosecutions are essential to the maintenance of an orderly society. So too, of course, are decisions of zoning officials, because finality and conclusiveness are required for the orderly maintenance of society. So those additional doctrines come into play and support the trial court's decision to sustain the demur to the malicious prosecution claim. Moving to the second claim that was alleged by the Eubanks, the abuse of process, that claim failed on the second element. To sustain a cause of action for abuse of process, a plaintiff must plead and prove, one, the existence of an ulterior purpose, and two, an act in the use of the process not proper in the regular prosecution of the proceedings. So said this court in Donahoe Construction versus Mount Vernon Associates, 235 Virginia 531. Here, the trial court properly sustained the demur because the complaint did not allege facts sufficient to satisfy the second element. There was no allegation of an act in the use of the summonses not proper in the regular prosecution. The sole fact that the plaintiff relies upon to defeat the demur is that the complaint alleged that Ms. Thomas met with the Commonwealth's attorney after the summonses had been issued and shared with the Commonwealth's attorney the allegedly modified sketch drawing in the course of that meeting. A complainant or a witness meeting with the prosecutor to prepare for the prosecution is not an improper act. It is not an irregular act. It is a proper and regular act in the course of a criminal proceeding and therefore cannot be an abusive process.
Counsel, may I take you back to this? Sorry, go ahead, Justice Powell.
Would it be an irregular act to present a document that is known not to be accurate? Their allegation is that they presented basically a doctored document. Wouldn't that be an irregular act?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. First of all, the complaint did not allege that Ms. Thomas herself modified the drawing, but accepting the inferences in the complaint and the allegations in the complaint as true, they still had probable cause because of the thing decided doctrine. They still did not have satisfactory evidence that was adduced through the course of the zoning process to satisfy them that the drawing wasn't inaccurate. I mean, there's no complaints to establish conclusively that it was inaccurate. There's an allegation that it was, but there's also an admission that it was never proven as it was required to be proven under the notice of violation. There's further admission that it was not appealed. So that was a proper act in the course of the proceeding. Moreover, if that gets into this argument that the Brady, that it was somehow a Brady violation, Brady does not apply to action. Brady is a duty to disclose to the defendant, and the defendants knew about this evidence already. There was no Brady violation here, even to the extent it could be extended, that the duty could
Counsel,
be extended.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey again. May I ask you this? Assume without conceding anything that the issue decided, the stare decisis, no collateral attack doctrine is inapplicable. Just assume that, but you're not conceding a thing. Do you still win this case on demur?
I think so, Your Honor, because I think that probable cause is not a high bar, as the case law sets forth. And we still have the, whether or not it results in a thing decided, we still have the Eubanks' failure to adduce sufficient evidence to challenge the finding of a violation. We still have the failure
Suppose they'd given you exactly what you had asked for. I know they didn't, as you claim, but suppose they'd given you exactly what you asked for, and it showed that the original footprint had not been expanded after 1966. Would you have had probable cause in that assumed scenario?
I I don't know, Your Honor. I mean, obviously, it's hard to assume allegations that weren't made in the complaint. The complaint, even aside from this, the complaint states or references that there were later notices of violations issued to the property. So it's quite possible that we could have argued that the complaint established a violation without regard to which one it was. But I do believe that would certainly have been a closer call. That was not the facts that the complaint was alleged, and the trial court, even accepting as true all the facts, was compelled to sustain the demur. Thank you, and we ask you to return.
Justice Kelsey, has she answered your question?
She has. Thank you, Chief.
All right. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
All right. We have rebuttal. 34 seconds, Mr. Bohannon.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think it is important to note that Ms. Eubanks was null prost. I believe Mr. Eubanks was dismissed, so there is some distinction there. But the appellee's argument is based on a principle that even a fictitious zoning violation, if not appealed and won, becomes true. A thing decided is to prevent relitigation on zoning issues and lessen the burden on a county and its resources. It's not meant to create legal fictions that lead to innocent people being charged with crimes. Thank you very much.
All right, the clerk will call the next case.